10%. It's a snowy one. Scattered snow showers today, a high of 31. An additional chance of some light snow this evening, a low around 20. Then for tomorrow, Friday, a slight chance of snow during the afternoon and evening hours. Tomorrow's high, 32. For the weekend, clouds on Saturday, a high of 32 again. For a Sunday, some snow moving in for the afternoon and evening hours. Sunday's high around 35. Right now, cloudy skies and 27. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The morning show with Greg Berg is coming up. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2020, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackanddrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Throughout the month of February, we're going to take at least one slot each week and devote it to an interview related to Black History Month. That is what we're doing with part one of today's morning show, an interesting conversation out of the morning show archives. This interview was recorded back in 2008.
Even if you're not a baseball fan, you probably are aware that this year marks a great milestone in professional baseball with the appearance in the majors of the first black ball player, Jackie Robinson. And there are many ways in which we can re-examine Jackie Robinson and his importance, his influence. One of the best ways is by looking at a book from ESPN called After Jackie, Pride, Prejudice, and Baseball's Forgotten Heroes, an oral history. And this book is written, edited by Cal Fussman, who was a contributing writer at ESPN, the magazine, and Esquire magazine as well. And in this book, we have gathered together the reminiscences of a number of African-American players who played with Jackie Robinson or were active right around that time, some of whom were great black ball players who never got a crack at the major leagues, others who did. And their stories are largely untold and to a large extent forgotten. Hence the importance of this really wonderful book to remind us about the courage of a number of black players who really helped to pave the way as Jackie Robinson did so extraordinarily. And we have Cal Fussman with us for the next few minutes to talk about his fascinating book. Cal Fussman, we welcome you to the morning show.
Great to be here, Greg.
Tell me how you got the idea for this particular book. I mean, was there any certain moment where you realized this was a book that needed to be written?
The book was not my idea, and it caught me by surprise. The book was the idea of a guy named Gary Honig, who was the editor of ESPN, the magazine, and he called me into his office and said, After Jackie, that being the title, and with the idea of looking into the lives of the guys who followed Jackie Robinson into Major League Baseball, the African Americans. And he had spent a day with Willie Mays, and in the course of that day, he realized that all of the things that he had seen from the stands or through the TV. He really had no idea of the story beneath the story, because Willie was saying, oh, you saw that, but let me tell you what really happened. And so when he sat me down, he basically said, I know there are all these stories out there, and I don't think that anybody has really gotten to them. And that's what opened the door. And then once the door was open, I really became surprised, because I came to realize that these stories, in many cases, had never been told, primarily because a lot of these guys, African Americans, they couldn't tell them at the time. And they basically stayed submerged, especially since many of the experiences were bitter.
Well, and of course, some of those men are now gone, but many of them are not. And you must have this sort of interesting sense that, this is so propitious for this program to be put together now, just as many of these principal players from this era are getting into their 80s and are not going to be with us longer. I mean, there is no time to lose in gathering these stories and preserving them.
Absolutely. When I was speaking with Don Newcomb, who's the last living African-American player to have played with the Dodgers and Jackie, I really got the sense that I am going to be speaking with him, and I don't know how long he'll have to speak with anybody after me. I had the same feeling with Buck O'Neill, and I got a chance to talk with the Negro League star for a few hours over a couple of days shortly before he died, and that was a real privilege. And so if I hadn't done this now, I don't think it would have been possible to come back 3 or 4 or 5 years later and do it now. Certainly, the next big anniversary would be 70 or 75 or the 75th year anniversary of Jackie breaking the color barrier. And at that point, there probably will be few of these guys remaining.
Mm-hmm. One of the things you say in the introduction to the book is the more you spoke with the men who came after Jackie, the more certain you became of one thing. The only way to unlearn is to learn. What do you mean by that?
Well, one of the things about race in America that I think is really hard for people to understand is that we can't really get a grip on it now. It was a lot easier to understand race in America back in the 60s when there were dogs being sent to go after African-American protesters, when we saw footage of black people not being allowed to sit at lunch counters. And everything at that point was black and white. Now, anybody can walk into a hotel with a credit card and is going to get a room. But the vestiges of race are still with us. Now it's kind of under the covers, and we really can't grip it. And so what I was able to do is talk to these ball players who have basically lived through this tremendous half century or 60 years and have seen what changes have transpired since the day of Jackie. And when you look at where they were, you can better understand where we are now.
We're speaking with Cal Fussman about his book, After Jackie, Pride, Prejudice, and Baseball's Forgotten Heroes. You do focus plenty of attention, of course, on Jackie Robinson himself. And in particular, it seems to me that one thing you do that is so valuable is you really help us try to understand, to whatever extent it's possible all these years later, having not stood in his shoes, to understand the kind of immense pressure which confronted Jackie Robinson, the huge pressure to do well and to be, as the phrase was back then, to be a credit to his race. Talk for a moment about the circumstances of Jackie Robinson breaking into the major leagues and some of the ways in which we might not stop to realize just how pressure-packed and difficult a situation it was.
Well, when we just take the word pressure, when you look at the word pressure in sports now, we might see it when somebody like Shaquille O'Neal goes to the foul line at the end of an NBA championship game. The score is tied, and he's got a chance to win the game with a foul shot, only he's one of the worst foul shooters in the league. That would be what we consider as a pressure-packed situation now. Back in 1947, basically 15 million African-Americans were living and dying on Jackie's at-bats. And on top of that, Jackie was stepping into a batter's box where the opposing pitchers were throwing at his head. He was used for target practice. In many cases, the opposing players were shouting racial trash at him. I bring up an anecdote in the book where against the Philadelphia Phillies in April of 1947, the Phillies knew that Jackie was getting death threats, and they lined up in the dugout and pointed baseball bats at him as if they were machine guns, and all made the machine gun sounds in order to distract him from getting a hit. And at the same time that was going on, Jackie really couldn't count for much help from his own teammates because many of them came from the South, and those players had to deal with the fact that they might be going home at the end of the season and being spit on or taunted for taking a shower with a black man, for eating with a black man. So you had pressure from the opposing team. It was pressure in his own dugout. And what many people might overlook is that there was even pressure in terms of the players who were in the Negro Leagues because Jackie Robinson was not seen as the best baseball player, African-American baseball player at the time. He was known as a college football star at UCLA. The Negro Leagues had many players who were better baseball players than Jackie Robinson, but Branch Rickey, the general manager of the Brooklyn Dodgers, chose Jackie because he had gone to college at UCLA. He had played in a diverse racial situation and in a league where there was a racial mixture. And so Branch Rickey was betting on the fact that since Jackie had done it before, that he'd have a good chance of making it work in Major League Baseball. So everywhere that Jackie turned, there was pressure.
When you say by the end of that first season, Jackie had swallowed centuries of condensed pressure and performed above it. That's such an intriguing choice of words there.
Well, he won the Rookie of the Year amidst all that pressure. He took the Brooklyn Dodgers to the World Series amidst that pressure. And really, at the end of that season, there was nobody in America who could say that blacks did not belong in baseball. And in fact, 11 weeks after Jackie's debut, Larry Doby was signed by the Cleveland Indians and became the second African-American in baseball. And two other African-American players came up that same season. And as soon as the major leagues saw that African-Americans could play on that level, then the doors were wide open.
This Branch Rickey is such an intriguing figure, isn't he? And we have in your book the opportunity to hear from his grandson, Branch Rickey III. What does he tell you about his grandfather and what motivated him to take this big step?
Well, it's interesting because Branch Rickey was a very complex man. He's been described as the Abraham Lincoln of baseball, and there was an incredible social conscience to the man. At the same time, Branch Rickey was a feared negotiator. In fact, his grandson tells a story about Ralph Kiner, the home run leader, going in to negotiate with his grandfather when his grandfather was general manager of the Pittsburgh Pirates. And Ralph Kiner obviously wanted a raise. And Branch Rickey didn't want to give him any more money, and he basically said, "Hey, Ralph, we would have finished in last place with you or without you." And so Branch Rickey was well known for being a fierce negotiator and not putting out a lot of money. And so you get the two sides here where Branch Rickey is taking part in this most noble of American experiments, and at the same time, Branch Rickey is making a huge amount of money off Jackie Robinson. He was in a situation where the Brooklyn Dodgers might have been half filling their ballpark before Jackie. The Yankees were getting huge crowds not far away. The New York Giants were doing well not far away. And so Branch Rickey basically watched as the Negro Leagues came into Yankee Stadium and sold 40,000 tickets to African Americans. And Branch Rickey quickly understood that if he brought Jackie Robinson to the Brooklyn Dodgers, those 40,000 African American fans would walk through the gates at Ebbets Field and be putting their money in the Brooklyn Dodgers catcher's register. So Branch Rickey, in the end, was very complicated, and people wonder what really was the reasoning behind his taking Jackie Robinson to the Brooklyn Dodgers. But as his grandson points out, it was a case where a great idea met financially great circumstances, and the two intertwined were incredibly powerful.
Right, money and morality.
You got it.
We're speaking with Cal Fussman about his book, After Jackie, Pride, Prejudice, and Baseball's Forgotten Heroes. So it's just like, for instance, the world of opera that I know a lot more about than baseball, that everybody knows the name of Marian Anderson, who was the first black to sing on the stage of the Metropolitan Opera, but not nearly so many people are acquainted with the other blacks who followed immediately in her wake, Mata Wilda Dobbs and Robert McFerrin and so on. They are relegated to very small footnotes in history, in a sense. And your book is a way to combat that injustice, in a sense, by reminding us about the courage and skill of some of the other players that came immediately in Jackie Robinson's wake. For instance, a member of the Cleveland Indians, signed by Bill Veeck, Larry Doby. Tell us what was so significant about him.
The sad part about Larry Doby is that he never got the accolades that Jackie got. He came into the major leagues 11 weeks after Jackie. He was subject to a lot of the same indignities. The big difference is that Jackie, playing in Brooklyn, had the concentration of the New York media around him, so that anything that happened to Jackie was likely to be reported on. Larry Doby was in Cleveland, where there were not many people in the media watching. And so he kind of played in obscurity. And not only that, but the American League was not as quick to embrace racial diversity as the National League. Bill Veeck was a maverick, and a very smart maverick, because he drew a huge number of people once Larry Doby joined the Indians. There were a few, the gates were more than 2 million in a season, and Bill Veeck quickly brought in Satchel Paige, who was a Negro League star, Minnie Minoso, a dark-skinned Cuban player, and those guys went through the American League that was, for the most part, lily white. So Larry Doby never got the recognition that Jackie Robinson did, and he was used as target practice for opposing pitchers, and he just had to kind of suffer through it in silence.
Well, and he labored, you say, virtually alone for a number of years in the American League. I mean, it was a lonesome road for him, more so than Jackie in some ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And not only that, but you also realize the ramifications of what he has to go through, because he later on sort of took the attitudes that he was confronted with, and they went into his home, and they came out in the way that he dealt with his kids, and he would never talk about what he went through to his son, Larry Doby Jr., when Larry Doby Jr. was a kid, and his kid could never really understand it, but he didn't want to poison his son by bringing up the old pain. And so you realize in talking to these guys that the history just doesn't stop in 1947. The attitudes get passed on from father to son, and then son to grandson. And what we're seeing when we talk to these guys is the arc of where we've come over the last 60 years race-wise.
One really interesting moment in Larry Doby's career is a dramatic photo which is taken in 1948 after he had hit a home run to help win a game in the World Series. Tell our listeners about this photograph and why it was sort of the shot heard around the world in a sense.
Okay. I'm looking at the photo right now, and it's Larry Doby in the clubhouse of the Cleveland Indians after the Indians have just won a World Series game. And Doby has his arms around a white pitcher for the Indians, Steve Gromick. And it's the first photo, the two of them hugging each other, of a white player, a white athlete, and a black athlete embracing that ever went out over the wire, meaning it was seen in newspapers across the country. And it was an incredible moment in that America was able to see this races coming together. And once a photo like that is snapped, it's impossible to go backward. And even though many of the taunts stayed on and Doby was thrown at for many years afterward, that photo showed that there was going to be a merging between the races, that it was going on and it wasn't going to be stopped. And it was one of the moments that Larry Doby was most proud of throughout his life, and he mentioned it when he was accepted into the Baseball's Hall of Fame.
We're speaking with Cal Fussman about his book, After Jackie, Pride, Prejudice, and Baseball's Forgotten Heroes. One of the most intriguing things, of course, about this moment in baseball history is that you indeed have these spectacularly talented black baseball players who are not a part of the major leagues. I mean, those doors are just tightly shut. And then Branch Rickey takes a step and brings aboard Jackie Robinson and and lo and behold, those doors swing open for others, including a gentleman far past his prime, but who manages to generate quite a bit of excitement nonetheless, Satchel Paige. Tell our listeners about his relatively brief yet significant career in the major leagues.
The way I looked at Satchel Paige was to imagine an all Caucasian NBA right now and maybe forever, and then trying to imagine Michael Jordan not being able to play in the NBA because it wouldn't allow black players in. It's almost impossible to believe. You know, Michael Jordan belongs in the NBA. He was the best. And Satchel Paige was the best African-American pitcher at the time. And Bob Feller, who was a Hall of Famer and a Caucasian pitcher, having watched Satchel, says that Satchel is one of the best pitchers ever. And yet he was not allowed to play in the major leagues for many, many years until Bill Veeck bought the Cleveland Indians, brought in Larry Doby, and then brought in Satchel Paige at perhaps age 42, nobody ever knew Satchel's real age because Satchel would make up funny stories. He once claimed that his birth certificate had been placed in a Bible and that a goat had eaten the Bible. So nobody knew how old he was, and obviously he liked not having anybody know how old he was because it made a good story. But Satchel Paige, at the age of 42, went to play for the Cleveland Indians, and he helped lead the Indians to the World Series on that same team with Larry Doby. What I found even more amazing than that is at the age of 59, he came back for a comeback attempt to play with the Kansas City club. And what happened was he was told that he needed to pitch or to join Kansas City Athletics and that he would get his pension, that he needed to fill out a little more time in the major leagues. What he didn't realize when he said that was that he was going to be asked to pitch three innings.
Right, not just show up as manager, but actually operate as a player that day.
At 59 years old, to go up against Carl Yastrzemski and the Boston Red Sox. And he basically took his 13-year-old son, dressed him up like a catcher out in the backyard, got a bucket of balls, and started to warm up. And his son could not believe like how good his dad really was, because he had heard all these stories. But now that his dad was pitching to him, he could not believe the velocity. And this is from Satchel Paige at 59. And Satchel Paige went out on the field at that age and pitched three innings against the Boston Red Sox. And I believe he gave up one hit, a double to Carl Yastrzemski. That was it. No runs. And it just makes you realize how good this guy was, because it's very hard to imagine any other pitcher going out on a major league diamond at the age of 59 and taking down the side.
One of the astonishing athletes from the Negro League was someone named Josh Gibson, who was called by somebody the Black Babe Ruth. He's one of the saddest stories, of course, because here is someone who, from all accounts, was brilliantly talented and yet was able to do so little with that because of life's circumstances.
Well, they say that had Josh Gibson played in the major leagues, he might be the all-time home run leader, not Babe Ruth at the time or Henry Aaron now. There are estimates, and there's no ways to prove this because records weren't always kept, that Josh had hit more than 800 home runs in his career. Henry Aaron right now has the major league lead at 755, which Barry Bonds is closing in on. But we really lost a great deal. And if you were a baseball fan, you didn't get a chance to see Josh Gibson play in the major leagues. It's kind of like saying, what if you took away Babe Ruth and he never got to play in the major leagues? He was just sort of a legend that you heard about playing in different parks around America. That's what was lost.
Yeah, and it's all but unthinkable.
Yeah. And the sad thing is that he died right around the time that Jackie had integrated baseball, and some claim that he was bitter that he wasn't the first one. But we do know that he apparently had a brain tumor, and it's hard to assess his like mental condition at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, really sad that he didn't get to show his talents for everybody.
Absolutely. Your book tells many, many stories of the indignities that black players suffered, particularly those in the minor leagues. And that goes on for a long, long time, especially in certain parts of the country. And that forms some of the most disturbing and frustrating stuff that we read. I want to close by asking you to share something that Don Newcomb talks about. He's the player that is the last black player to have played with Jackie Robinson. When he said that just shortly before Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated, apparently Dr. King told Don Newcomb that he and Jackie Robinson and the other great black ball players had really made a huge difference in making the advances of the civil rights movement possible.
Yeah, it was a dinner a month before Martin Luther King was assassinated, and Martin Luther King said to him, "Don, I don't know what I would have done without you guys setting up the minds of people for change. You and Jackie and Roy Campanella will never know how easy you made it for me to do my job." Now, can you imagine Martin Luther King's job being made any easier? It's staggering. But as we were talking about before, Jackie Robinson opened the door for everybody to see America in a different light. And Martin Luther King was able to come through that door and amplify what Jackie was getting at. And we're seeing that to this day with the fact that Barack Obama is running for president of the United States, and people have contributed $25 million to his campaign.
It is a different world in many respects. The book is called After Jackie, Pride, Prejudice, and Baseball's Forgotten Heroes, an Oral History. It is published by ESPN Books. It gathers the reminiscences of many black players of this era, and some white players as well, such as the great pitcher Bob Feller, offering their own perspectives on this crucial point in baseball history. Cal Fussman from ESPN, I thank you so much for this fascinating book and for talking about it with me on The Morning Show. Best wishes.
Hey, thank you. That was really great.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. We spend the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show talking about innovation, the concept of innovation, and how innovation is happening in this new era, the way in which new technologies have changed the very nature in which innovation occurs, the speed with which innovations emerge and develop and spread, and the ways in which innovation is possible from all quarters and not limited to a certain select, well-connected few. The book at hand is called Speed and Greed. Need, Speed, and Greed: How the New Rules of Innovation Can Transform Businesses, Propel Nations to Greatness, and Tame the World's Most Wicked Problems. The author of the book is Vijay Vaitheeswaran, who is an award-winning global correspondent for The Economist. Perhaps you know his previous book, Zoom, The Global Race to Fuel the Car of the Future, and another book called Power to the People: How the Coming Energy Revolution Will Transform an Industry, Change Our Lives, and Maybe Even Save the Planets. He is a regular contributor to the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and for that matter, NPR's Marketplace. Again, this new book published by HarperCollins is called Need, Speed, and Greed. And Vijay Vaitheeswaran, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
It's great to be with you.
I wonder if you could say a word about the concept of innovation itself, how you are using that term in this book, and how innovation is such a crucial matter for us to be talking about right now.
Absolutely, and thank you for asking that, because I think innovation is actually the most abused word in the English language. Think about how often people talk about innovation without really defining what they mean. So I will start by saying what it is not. Innovation is not invention. It's not technology, even though oftentimes when people say innovation, they're really talking about technology or patents or intellectual property rights or gadgets or gizmos. In my view, that misses the point. Innovation is fresh thinking, which may or may not involve new technology, that creates value. And that value can be created if you're a company for your shareholders and your customers. But if, let's say, you're an arm of government or you're a social enterprise, one of the new novel breeds of very interesting, dynamic, hybrid NGOs that are emerging, then that value could be created for your stakeholders or for citizens. So fresh thinking that creates value, not just gadgets, gizmos, patents, R&D spending.
Hmm. That being said, I thought it was interesting at one point in the book when you say that innovation is not always a good thing. And the definition you just offered up, I mean, at a glance, I should say, sort of sounds like something entirely positive. But go ahead.
This is where the greed part of my title comes in. Innovation can be applied towards creating value by drug dealers, for example, in the drug cartels for their customers. You know, in the 1990s, I covered Latin America as the bureau chief for my magazine down in Mexico City, and I saw how the Mexican drug cartels rose. They were very inventive. They had great technology. They had nimble business models. And for people who were their suppliers and customers, you know, they created value for them. But I think as society, we would say that's malicious innovation. That's sort of deviant globalization. And my argument is that if we're going to tame some of the world's really difficult problems, the wicked problems, like whether it's climate change or whether it's the fact that we're living in an age of deadly pandemics, because of our very interconnectedness to other parts of the world, whether we're, how do we deal with the resource crunch that is arising because of the rise of China and India and other countries? Well, we need to have more rewards going to innovators that work on those difficult social problems. And that's part of my point, that we need to go from a model of capitalism where greed is good to harnessing greed for good so that we give more rewards to innovators that work on socially important problems.
Right. I remember in this part of the book where you talk about innovation being used for, in a sense, for ill gain. You talk not only about how sometimes it's, you know, downright evil forces that capitalize on innovation, such as the example you just used, but you go on to say that that often these kind of innovations have been used in history at redistribution rather than at producing new wealth. That is, sometimes innovation is used in a sense to entrench one's own well-being or to divert well-being away from others to you. And you're suggesting that innovation has a higher calling than that.
Yeah, I guess the way I would put it is this. You know, through all of human history, people live more or less exactly the same. There was a wonderful cartoon in The New Yorker a couple of years ago with a Stone Age family sitting around with no material possessions in view other than a stick. And the father looks at the son and says, "When I was your age, things were exactly the same as they are now." And that's exactly how humanity lived for millennia after millennia, except the last 150 years, right? And something different has happened with the rise of industrial revolution, with capitalism, with certain kinds of financial and markets innovation, with new social organizations. So we are actually living through an extraordinary period of human history, and I believe that's only going to accelerate. So the simple explanation for why we don't live like in the Stone Ages is, in fact, innovation that has improved the social welfare, right? So, but most of that was driven by entrepreneurial forces from the bottom up. Through most of history, and what the chapter you're referring to about, had kings and pharaohs that would appropriate all the rents, all the money that was made from inventions. So the Chinese, for example, for 18 of the last 20 centuries, China was the wealthiest place on earth. But the Chinese people were poor. Even though China invented paper and gunpowder, the printing press, and the list goes on, it was a very inventive society. All of the profits and all of the societal gain that came from that was captured by the emperor and a few elites around him. So I would argue that the value was not created for society. That was invention, but it wasn't innovation in the way that I'm talking about, because the elites captured the benefits. So what I'm talking about today is we live in an age where innovation is much more democratic, both in the creation of new ideas and new inventions, many people around the world can participate in that process, but also in the benefits being shared. And for me, this is a great time to be alive.
Mm. One of the intriguing things about your book is that, although that is one point made, that is that this is a great time to be alive, what an amazing age in which we live, this is also an age in which the planet is confronting some very frightening challenges, and you repeatedly use the term wicked to describe the greatest problems that our planet faces. And I think what is at the heart of this duality in your book, that is this attention given to very, very frightening problems, but also this tremendous potential to meet those problems head on, is this notion of globalization, all of these new ways in which all of us are very powerfully connected. Talk for a moment about how globalization is, in a sense, the cause of some of our greatest ills, or an aggravating factor in some of our greatest ills, and at the same time, the source of some of our greatest hopes and highest potentials.
Sure. Now, I don't want to fall into the trap of claiming we've never been globalized before, right? So if you look at history, back in Roman times, the Romans traded with India for pepper and spices. So there have been other eras where the globe was connected through trade. Marco Polo famously traveled all over Asia and came back with new ideas that helped build Europe's conquest of the world. But what's different about this wave of globalization, which is much deeper than any that came before it, is that added to that is also something I call Googleization. So when you take globalization and Googleization of the world together, what you find is a kind of hyper-interconnectedness that is transforming how we think, how people act, how we create businesses, how anywhere in America there is, whatever your organization is, you can be disrupted by upstarts from other parts of the world that can challenge you. And that's because the very nature of innovation has gone from being sort of a silo. The way that AT&T, Bell Labs, or Xerox PARC, or most companies used to do very secretive ways of developing inventions, bringing them to market, keeping patents very close to their chest. Well, the new model, thanks to the forces we're talking about, are open, networked, user-generated models of innovation, and that is going across industries. It's not just the software guys from Silicon Valley, but industry after industry is being affected by what's happening in other markets, particularly emerging markets, where frugal engineering, that is cheaper ways of doing things that sometimes can be much better, are coming up and challenging established ways of doing things. I say all this because there is a duality. This is the reason I have hope that we can take on the seamy underbelly of globalization and Googleization among the things that are happening because of our hyperconnectedness. Superbugs, so-called bacterial superbugs that are now spreading with our pipeline for antibiotics is very nearly depleted. We are unable to handle many of the new kinds of bugs that are emerging and spreading rapidly because of how connected we are. I used to be our pharmaceuticals correspondent for The Economist, so I spent a lot of time talking to the heads of R&D, for example, at pharma and biotech, and it is scary when they acknowledge that the cupboard is bare when it comes to future antibiotics. And even a field like genomics, which is bringing so many positive things, when it comes to antibiotics, they've given up. Genomics isn't going to help us in finding new antibiotics. So that's the kind of challenge I talk about in sober terms in the book. But I also say there are such new forces of innovation. I want to connect the problems, the wicked problems, with the emerging solutions. And we're not doing that well enough yet. Hmm. And to do that, we need the power of incentive, what I call greed.
One thing you, a point you make repeatedly, is that when we hear about and see innovation occurring in other places, we as Americans, you would advise us to sort of tamp down what might be our initial reactions of envy and especially fear that somehow an innovation that occurs someplace else is sort of happening, in a sense, at our expense or to our detriment. And again and again, you make the point that innovation is not a zero-sum game, and that, in a sense, innovation anywhere can be a benefit for everybody, in a sense. I mean, can be.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, this is one of the great fallacies that's now caught hold of our political system, that innovation is somehow a pie that's fixed. And if China's up, then America must be down. That the difficulties that we're having in the heartland of America, the middle class squeeze, is somehow because China is eating our lunch, just to give the latest bogeyman. Let's remember, 30 years ago, that bogeyman was Japan, right? And every commentator and even many experts said, well, Japan is eating our lunch, and that's America's going to lose its greatness. And that was complete baloney, let's be honest about it. History shows that Japan's peaceful rise went hand in hand with America becoming a much more prosperous nation. We did not become a second-rate power because of Japan. If anything, because of its own problems at home, Japan has put a limit on its own growth. It has been going sideways for 20 years. It was unable to recover from a financial and real estate bubble, and it lost out on all the industries of the internet, of social networking, of big data, where America has reinvented itself and created the industries of the future, right? So I think that we need to debunk some of this, in my view, demagoguery that's coming from some political leaders. And remember that the way innovation works is no longer possible to put up a big wall around America or China, for that matter. China's leaders are making the same mistake. They want to be an innovation powerhouse. They have policies for what they call indigenous innovation, that is, only made in China innovation. And to me, and I've criticized this policy on the pages of my magazine, this is folly. I mean, this is you cannot put up a moat around your country and say only innovations that are created here are going to make us great. That means you're destined to fail. And that's because innovation is actually much more global. You know, the markets are linked, but so are the people coming up with inventions. There's a notion that we used to have that when talented people leave a country, this is brain drain. This was seen as a terrible thing. What we now understand, when we look at the innovation hotspots around the world, whether it's parts of America like Silicon Valley or San Diego in the case of biotech, which is the world's leading cluster in biotech, Israel, which is perhaps the world's most dynamic small economy, the software cluster in southern India that's pretty famous now, Taiwan, which is also a hotspot, these are actually connected by venture capital, by people traveling back and forth, by business models that straddle the globe. Think of it as brain circulation, not brain drain.
That's a very nice concept, actually. And we read in your book much more of how this plays out, all kinds of very specific examples, in particular the speed of innovation and the way in which even the world of technology and various companies can no longer operate in their self-contained silos, and ultimately the way in which we can channel forces like good old-fashioned greed to make it a force for good, all explored in this fascinating book called Need, Speed, and Greed: How the New Rules of Innovation Can Transform Businesses, Propel Nations to Greatness, and Tame the World's Most Wicked Problems. The book is published by HarperCollins. And Vijay Vaitheeswaran, I appreciate you joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about your intriguing book. Thank you.
My great pleasure. Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we will preview the Lakeside Players production of Little Shop of Horrors. Next week, some interesting interviews planned as well. On Monday, local author Michael Schumacher and a book he edited called Allen Ginsberg, South American Journals, January to July 1960. On Tuesday, for Black History Month, a rebroadcast of my interview with Isabel Wilkerson, author of an extraordinary book called The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's Great Migration, tells the story of the massive migration over the course of many decades of Southern blacks into the rest of the United States. Next Wednesday, Abraham Lincoln's birthday, something I'm very excited to share with you. an interview from back in the mid-1990s with Bill Guy, the originator of the morning show, talking with local Lincoln